Welcome to Not Enough Champagne, a podcast about politics. My name's Corey Hazelhurst and my partner in propaganda is Steve Haynes.
Hello!
In this episode, we are looking at the legacy of Barack Obama. Barack Obama became president on November the 4th, 2008. Now, I have a quiz, Steve, on the events of November 2008.
Of course you do.
What was UK number one on November the 4th, 2008?
I'm pretty sure by 2008 I'd stopped paying attention to the charts and was listening almost solely to heavy metal. So I'm going to take a guess and say, I don't know, Lady Gaga? That seems like the kind of time she was breaking out, maybe. I don't know.
Number one was The Promise by Girls Aloud. Do you remember Girls Aloud?
I remember Girls Aloud. I don't know the song The Promise.
I would sing it to you, but my voice is a bit off this week.
Every week.
So that was November the 4th. On November the 5th, the day after, a Brit became the youngest Formula One champion. Who was that?
Oh, that's Lewis Hamilton.
On the 6th of November, there was a by-election in Glenthrows. Who won that by-election?
You're just doing this to mock me now, aren't you? I have no idea.
Lindsay Roy, he won the seat with a majority of 5,500 from the SNP, which I think shows how long ago this was, in that Labour could actually win by-elections in Scotland and the SNP would finish second.
Wow.
Shows how long ago it was.
Memories.
Then on the 7th of November, there were American job figures that were published. How many jobs did America lose in the month of October?
The month of October?
In 2008.
So crash was summer, early autumn. So we are looking at, let's call it 150,000.
Close. 240,000 jobs lost.
I'm happy with that.
I think this gives an idea of the context in which Obama starts, doesn't it? So those 240,000 jobs took American unemployment to 6.5%, mm-hmm. which was its highest level in decades. The UK economy in October had fallen in that previous quarter by 0.5%, which was the first time it had contracted since 1992. I think when you're looking at the post-mortems of Barack Obama's presidency, what Obama in his farewell speech and what a lot of commentators have talked about as well is the strength of his economic record. Although I think probably a few people would say he didn't change the fundamentals of the economy in maybe a way they would like. The stimulus pulled America out of the recession, avoided the depression. There was strong wages growth towards the end of his presidency. There was strong jobs creation. Inequality was starting to decline and be addressed as well.
I think when it comes to the economics issue, one kind of elephant in the room which kind of needs to be addressed. Yes, overall the economics of the of America are better now at the end of Obama's presidency than they were when he first started. However, the perception around the economy is not necessarily as good. And this largely boils down to the fact that yes, now we are starting to see wage growth for the poorest in America. But throughout most of his presidency, that wasn't the case. And it's actually that lack of growth for the kind of the poorest, and indeed actually within the kind of the lower edges of the middle classes as well, which has led to the rise of Trump in a number of ways. Because broadly speaking, ethnic minorities in the US view their economic security based on do they have a job. White people in America don't view economic security in the same way. For them, economic security is not just about having a job, it's about having savings, it's about that wage growth and things like that. Which is why actually in the Democratic primary you had very interesting splits, in that you had ethnic minorities who were quite happy with the strength of the economy backing Clinton, but you had kind of more white, more liberal, quote-unquote, voters who were more middle class and hadn't got but viewed their economic situation based on comparison to where it was rather than to everyone else in the country. They were much more upset about the state of the economy because they hadn't got back their 401ks or they weren't able to save quite as much as they would before.
Were backing Sanders.
Yeah, and they were backing Sanders. So with this, when you're talking about Obama's legacy, you've got to, especially when it comes to the economics of the situation, is that, yeah, overall, when you look at the data, it looks good. And everybody should, in theory, when they write the history books, go, Barack Obama did a good job with the economy. But what he didn't do a good job of was necessarily providing growth to the areas which were necessary to kind of keep hit the rest of his legacy intact.
And so that leads to what Michael Moore, in a prediction before the election, called this Rust Belt Brexit. Yeah. So this idea that places like Ohio, Wisconsin, they voted for a populist candidate. Trump said that he would restore coal mines and that he would bring back jobs to America that have been outsourced to China.
Yeah, absolutely.
We're going to talk first about the executive orders that Obama has passed and whether Trump will be able to just overturn a lot of what Obama has done. And then secondly, we're going to talk about whether or not he created ISIS. We'll do that after this. So Enoch Powell said that all political...
Sorry, you just threw an Enoch Powell curveball at me there. What? Okay, go on.
So Enoch Powell said that all political careers end in failure.
Okay.
Yeah.
I wondered where you were going with that.
This is not the pivot. Do you think that Obama's career ends in failure because he's being succeeded by someone who is the antithesis of him?
I mean, I think this is actually quite a difficult question to answer.
That's why I've asked you.
I know, you're a bastard for it. I mean, if you're going to take that approach to kind of assessing his legacy, then you need to probably give it a bit more time as to see what Trump actually does. Because so much of what Trump has said he wants to do is undoing specific parts of Obama's legacy. So the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare, it stands out as the most obvious example of this. It's very difficult for the Republicans to repeal and replace Obamacare whilst kind of cutting some of the aspects that they don't like, which fund a lot of the aspects that the public at large likes.
And that Trump has said he likes as well. I mean, he said that people with pre-existing conditions should still be able to get insurance.
Yeah, but the only way you can make that happen, for instance, is by making it a mandate that everybody needs to have insurance. Because if you don't do that, there's just not enough money in the insurance pool for the insurance providers to actually make it work.
Mm. I mean, there were stories after the election of, I think, elderly voters maybe in Florida who voted for Trump and then were wondering if they'd be able to keep their Obamacare. And I suppose on one level you think, well, why did you vote for Trump then, you stupid, stupid people? But on the other hand, these people are still entitled to healthcare and still need healthcare, and they're going to need some sort of plan put in place.
Yeah, which is very much why I think you need. It's still a bit too early to say what Obama's legacy is actually going to be, because yes, the American people have voted in someone who is the antithesis of Barack Obama, but what they've also seem to like is a number of the things that he has actually done, which, you know, Donald Trump has come out against, or the Republicans who control Congress are against.
Mm.
Those kind of conflicts between popular public opinion and Trump and the Republican-controlled House and Senate means that we don't actually know what they're going to do for a number of these things. Now, yes, we can take a large bet and say that a number of environmental regulations will probably be overturned. But those have never really been viewed as parts of Obama's legacy. When they write the history books, they will say Barack Obama was a progressive who believed in climate change and did X, Y, Z to help combat it. Yes, Trump will probably undo those, but it's not one of the defining moments of Obama's presidency. Mm. And all of the things that actually matter to that defining legacy are things where it's quite complicated for the Republicans to actually get rid of. So I think you need to wait and see as to what they actually do before you can make that argument, because it could be that electing someone who is the antithesis of Barack Obama in the form of Trump means, yeah, an awful lot of his legacy is scrapped. But it could also mean that just the realpolitik of the situation means that nothing much happens, in which case his legacy is secure.
I can't see Donald Trump being the kind of populist politician that's going to take healthcare away from people. And you have a feeling that a healthcare plan that Paul Ryan would want to get through Congress is the kind of healthcare plan where actually people, money is cut, people do lose their funding, maybe Medicaid is privatised. I don't think President Trump would want that.
I don't think Trump would care until he started seeing polling numbers and things like that, which showed exactly how unpopular it is. And as long as it wasn't Trump care, that was the plan that was going forward. As long as it's Paul Ryan's plan or someone, or Rand Paul's plan or someone else's plan, then he would happily stick his neck out and say, it is absolutely shocking that the Republican-controlled House and Senate are doing these things. I will veto this, or they need to stop it. And he's already started, for instance, doing little things like that. He's not even president yet, but one of the first acts the Republicans did when they came back into Congress for the new year was look to change the ethics oversight organisation's independence so that it would be put under the jurisdiction of the ethics watchdog, which is sat on by congressmen and senators and things like that. So it's not really very effective. Trump tweeted out that this was poor timing and that there are more better things for them to be focusing on. That tweet itself didn't actually change the minds of the Congress of the Republican Party on this when you actually look into the timing of it, but it does show that he is actually happy to kind of use his bully pulpit to slap down to at least a certain extent the Republican Party at large.
In Trump's infamous first press conference as president-elect, he talked about repealing and replacing Obamacare basically on the same day or within a few hours of each other. I have a horrible feeling that what will probably happen is there'll be some sort of fudge and they'll repeal Obamacare, and a plan almost identical to Obamacare will actually be put in place. They'll almost, on the Affordable Care Act, they'll just go find and replace, and it'll be like replace some with a few or replace many with a lot. And it'll be almost indistinguishable, but Trump will be able to say, I've repealed Obamacare, I've replaced it. That won't please Paul Ryan, but I have a feeling that, as you've just indicated, he doesn't really care whether or not he pleases Paul Ryan or not.
No, and what you're talking about there is pretty likely to happen, or at least that's what Trump would like to happen. The issue is, the minute he goes down after that kind of route, the Freedom Caucus will just kind of let loose. Because you will have the Ted Cruz's of the world and all that actually just kind of going, no, this is just Obamacare. Because a number of them will quite happily break ranks on that sort of stuff.
Does Trump care about lying Ted, though?
He doesn't need to care. He needs their vote, though.
But I suppose it depends how Trump goes. If that plan is put through, he might well be able to get Democratic support for that.
Absolutely he might do, but at the same time then that means the Democrats have a pulpit of themselves at which they can go, this is just Obamacare. Yeah, of course we're going to vote for it. Donald Trump's just wasted everybody's time with this. At which point that puts him at a very significant media disadvantage. There needs to be something quite significantly different in it for it to actually work. And unfortunately, really the only way it can be made different are if you cut aspects of it. Or you remove funding for other things. There might be a combination of changes around the edges which might work, but it's going to be very difficult to do.
So you do find and replace on most things, and you find a thing that you can say, this makes it Trump. A kind of ginger toupee that you put on the Affordable Care Act and say, this is mine now, I own this. It's different enough.
Yeah, but it's very difficult to actually find what that is, because especially is something that would keep the Republicans happy, because the bits they don't like and the bits which the Republican base don't like are, in effect, the individual mandate, which we've already discussed. If you don't have that, the system doesn't work. And the tax aspects of it, which goes on like the highest earners, goes basically to fund an expansion in Medicare and Medicaid. And if you cut that, you're cutting OAPs and veterans. No, veterans especially is very bad optics, because all the Democrats then have to do is at their national convention is roll out a string of people with purple hearts and military honours and say, I don't have a health insurance anywhere because of Donald Trump.
I think the thing with how Obama was president and maybe the leeway that gives to Trump is in Obama's increased use of executive power.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in a sense, Obama had to use some form of executive power because he couldn't get anything through Congress. We've talked about the healthcare reform. That was passed 6 years ago. It was the last piece of substantial legislation that Congress has been able to be passed. Mostly that's because of Republican obstructionism, isn't it?
Yeah, an awful lot of it is just down to Republican obstructionism and them just basically going, we're not going to pass anything that Barack Obama wants passed because, you know, he's not our president. we don't, a number of them don't genuinely probably don't actually believe he's even a legitimate president, even though he's blatantly got a birth certificate which is from the USA. And that entire kind of approach by the Republicans is relatively new.
Mm.
You know, if you look back at even former, you know, former problematic speakers of the House, such as Newt Gingrich, Clinton was still able to get Bill Clinton was able still able to get things through. They may not have been as progressive as he would have liked. They may not have been as wide ranging as he liked, but he was able to get things through. That's something that Barack Obama was just not able to do.
Yeah, I mean, you look at the Civil Rights Act, for instance, in '64. A higher proportion of Republicans voted for that Civil Rights Act than Democrats,
mm-hmm.
even though it was passed by a Democratic president, Lyndon Johnson.
Yep.
But Republicans got no credit for that in '64 because they chose as their nominee one of the few Republicans who didn't sign that act, yeah. Barry Goldwater. I mean, the whole American political system is predicated on the fact that parties will work together.
Yeah.
It's not like Britain, where, like it or lump it, the idea is that we have a government that tries to pass stuff and an opposition that opposes stuff, or usually, anyway.
Yeah, and this is where the current situation in Congress becomes very interesting to watch over the next 4 years or so. Because you have Democrats who are basically saying, we want to do what the Republicans did and just obstruct. Why would we vote to confirm or allow a confirmation of Trump's Supreme Court pick? You know, there's lots of things that they could do, which the Republicans were doing, and you're going to see a split amongst the Democratic Party about how to actually approach that sort of stuff, because most of the Trump White House, except possibly, weirdly enough, Trump himself, is politically savvy enough to know that the way to get things done is to give your opponents a little bit. So,
in Obama's first 7 years as president, there were 560 major regulations he passed through executive order, which is a huge amount. It's 50% more than George Bush did. And all kinds of things from overtime pay to the fact that women can buy emergency contraception without a prescription, the fact that we can now eat genetically engineered salmon, apparently. There's also 100 of them were to improve LGBT rights.
And again, this is potentially one of the areas where the Obama legacy could potentially be all right. Trump, in many ways, when it comes to LGBT issues, is not a typical Republican. In his speech when he was officially nominated to be the Republican presidential nominee, he made a reference to LGBT. There was a Most of the hall was quite quiet, but there was a smattering of kind of whooping and a hollering and applause. And there was one of those moments of him going off script happened that he said, I'm so glad you guys were happy for that. I didn't think you'd applaud that. Trump, in many ways, is horrific in his politics, but in LGBT areas, he may not be that bad. Obviously, it remains to be seen.
Yeah, that's New York values for you, I suppose.
Exactly.
Both Trump and Clinton were talking about easing the burden of regulation. Clinton is just as much of a light touch, close to Wall Street, less regulation as Trump would have been, probably. Which is, again, maybe one of the reasons she lost.
See, this is the thing. I do wonder, as much as like the Republicans have said that, oh yeah, there's going to be a bonfire of like the executive orders and all the things that Obama's passed. I mean, I'm sure there will be some which do definitely get overturned. But really? I just can't see them actually kind of spending that much time on a number of those things, because some of them are so niche and so specific. One is going to take quite a while, I think, actually, for a number of those to actually make their way to the top of the to-do list, just because based on the way that the transition has happened so far, I find it hard to believe that Trump and his team have been focusing on that aspect of it yet.
My favourite bit of his press conference, apart from when he said, you're fired at the end when you think you're in the middle of a terrible game show, but it was when he said, people don't want me to sort out the minutiae, people want me to run the country. And you think, well, that literally is your job. We talked about control freak Theresa May last week.
Yeah.
It's a very different form of executive power.
Yeah, and this is a game where potentially Trump's own personality comes into it. Because, yeah, you could say, well, what will happen is Mike Pence or someone like that, or the Republican Party and Paul Ryan, will draw up a list of things they want to get rid of. And they'll put that in front of Donald Trump, and then Donald Trump were expecting him to just sign it all off.
A bit like Radio O'Reilly in MASH.
Yeah, pretty much. In reality, though, I don't think Trump's the sort of person who puts his name to anything without knowing what it is. Because Trump, at the end of the day, is all about his brand, and it's the sort of thing where if he doesn't know what it is, he will ask questions about it. He may not care that much, but if he sees an issue with it, he will then say, well, why would I want to do this? You need to give me a good, damn good reason to do this. And that's the point where the Republicans and a number of those executive orders don't get into trouble.
They could give him some stakes and get him to put his name on that instead.
Yeah, quite possibly.
I think the thing with the executive orders, though, maybe with Obama, is the precedent it sets. I mean, one of them, for instance, is so the increasing power of the US president to make war. So FDR in the 40s had to get congressional approval to join the war. Woodrow Wilson couldn't get America into the League of Nations, which was his brainchild, because the Senate obstructed him from doing it. Then Harry Truman brings America into the Korean War because he says it's not a war, it's a police action that the UN validate. Then in 2014, when Obama launched airstrikes in Syria, he says he doesn't need congressional approval because it's a humanitarian war. So it's a very big change in 60, 70 years in terms of what Congress needs to do for the president to approve a war. When you've got someone like Trump in charge, I wonder if maybe Obama set a dangerous precedent there.
Potentially, but again, I don't think when it comes to foreign policy, Trump will be paying that much attention. I think it's Pence, I think it's, assuming he gets confirmed, Tillerson, and a few others who probably actually set that agenda. There will be some basic things which they basically go, is Donald Trump likely to care about this? Oh, it involves Russia. Better run that past him. With international relations and foreign policy, 90% of the time, the issues that arise are the unexpected. So everyone is currently sat there kind of going, what's Russia going to do? What's Russia going to do? What's Russia going to do? Chances are the first real foreign policy crisis that Trump has to deal with is going to be China. Or it's going to be something in Southern America. It's going to be Portugal suddenly, you know, had a coup or something random like that, you know, something that you're not even necessarily thinking about.
If it happens, Liz, we had nothing to do with it. We didn't know. It's a random country. Shall we pivot from that to ISIS?
Let's.
Right. So, something that Donald Trump said on the campaign trail is that, and we alluded to it in the opening of this piece, is that Barack Obama created ISIS.
When you say Barack Obama creates ISIS, I mean, there was a lot of kind of, during the election and the run-up to it, there was very much a case of him going, of course he didn't create, but Obama didn't create ISIS. That's just a dumb thing to say. But when you actually look at it from, say, how a historian would look at it, and look at the context of ISIS's rise, look at the decisions which led to them actually being able to exist as they do today, then there is a very strong case to be made that they are Barack Obama's greatest legacy in terms of foreign affairs, simply because on many foreign issues, he was incredibly weak. I say that as someone who is quite hawkish on foreign policy, and I do admit that, and I'm very aware I am quite hawkish on foreign policy.
You can't see the hooked nose, but it's definitely
there. But when your stance on Syria is, well, these are the lines in the sand. If you use chemical weapons, yeah, we're going to get involved. We're going to get involved if you use chemical weapons. And then Assad uses chemical weapons and you don't get involved, then that opens up that power vacuum, because Assad is then fighting various rebels, including ISIS, including Al-Qaeda, including some reasonable people as well, which means Syria gets into an absolute state, which means ISIS are able to claim aspects of it, and from those areas able to grow out of there and go into other areas. And I do think that Obama's main legacy for foreign affairs is going to be the rise of ISIS. Not in that he created it, but I do genuinely think he could have been a hell of a lot more smarter of how to deal with it.
I think you're conflating two things there. So you're conflating the rise of ISIS with the quagmire we have at the moment in Syria and the emboldening of Russia through Obama's inaction. And I think you're perfectly right that allowing Assad to cross the red line you set is a massive error, which not only emboldens Assad to take on his own people,
it but also demonstrates that there is no help coming from the Americans, so more people go towards ISIS.
And it also emboldens Vladimir Putin to get involved in Syria and probably get involved and get Russia more involved in the geopolitical stage as well.
Yeah.
Would Russia have tried to hack democratic emails if Obama had been bolder.
Yeah, it's an interesting kind of hypothetical.
But ISIS were well on their way before Obama missed those red lines in Syria. I think as far as I can understand it, the case for Obama creating ISIS, for want of a better way of putting it, is that in 2011, when US troops were still in Iraq, there was a government in Iraq that was being propped up with American troops, and Obama
withdrew those troops.
Withdrew those troops early, which creates that vacuum for ISIS.
Yeah, and it's all about that power vacuum and that destabilisation within that part of the Middle East. And I do think, whether it be the withdrawal of the troops from Iraq potentially a bit too soon, I think with that situation, there's never a good time to do it. And I can totally see why Obama did withdraw them when he did. But I think that clearly that opens up the vacuum. You know, that does lead to the first kind of foothold for ISIS as a entity. But I do think that that with ISIS's growth, it's all about the kind of almost the snowball effect. It's each of those different decisions leads to more destabilization in the region, and that lack of a strong response from Obama at any point, basically, means that snowball keeps getting bigger and bigger and bigger, and it's the region becomes more unstable, which gives ISIS an even more of a foothold.
I think that destabilisation, I don't think that Obama is the main person to blame for that. I mean, weirdly, I've seen Tom and Jerry blamed for the rise of ISIS.
Which is beautiful.
Because apparently Tom and Jerry desensitised children to violence, as one Egyptian politician has claimed, which I think is the itchy and scratchy view of history.
I was going to say, I grew up on Tom and Jerry cartoons, and I haven't gone off to help form the caliphate yet.
But when he does, listeners, we'll know why.
Yep.
It's Tom and Jerry's fault. In terms of the destabilisation that Iraq has and that snowball effect, Obama is not the cause of that. The cause of that is the 2003 invasion.
Yeah, I mean, this is the thing with any kind of international relations and looking at how countries interact. You can always trace it back to something.
Hell, to something that Tony Blair did,
obviously. Almost certainly, yeah. But you can always trace it back to some other event, because nothing happens in a vacuum. I mean, if you want to take that kind of approach, then hell, you might as well blame Reagan for Iran-Contra and the relationship between the US and Iran and all of that
but
sort of stuff.
The invasion of Iraq, it's not just the invasion, it's the depathification afterwards. So the fact that when the American forces take over Baghdad, they sack the Iraqi army. Anyone who was a member of the Ba'ath Party leaves government posts.
Yep.
And that means that, same in any totalitarian society, if you're a teacher, you have to be a member of the Ba'ath Party to be a teacher. It doesn't necessarily mean that you're a Saddam-loving fascist. It just means you want to teach people how to have a job. And those people leave their jobs. Now, ISIS, when they first started, they recruited a lot of the people. Some of them were in prisons, in American-held prisons, but a lot of them were ex-Iraqi soldiers who left the army because of that de-Ba'athification. And that's why I think Bush is more to blame than Obama, and that first invasion is to blame, and how that invasion was held, because without that de-Ba'athification, you would not have had, you would have, that led to loads of people who were decent soldiers and were ripe for recruitment by a terrorist group.
So, to which my response to that is, as if you're Barack Obama coming into office in 2009 for the first time, you know that has something that has gone on. You've been informed that this is what's happened, and you probably already know from being a senator anyway. What was your strategy to deal with it?
I think Obama makes two assumptions which are wrong. One of them is ironically the same that George Bush made, which is, we go in, we build a democracy, everything is fine. And that was what Bush seems to have thought in Iraq coming in, is that you get rid of all the people who were there before, you bring in a new constitution, you have a democracy, you have some sort of neoliberal society, and it works fine. Which obviously doesn't work. And I think Obama makes that same mistake in 2011, where he thinks, well, Iraq's got a functioning government, it's got a functioning democracy, and therefore it'll be fine. Forgetting that you can't just bring a democracy on people, you need to have peaceful agreements, you need to have peaceful transitions of power, you need to have an agreed view of legitimate violence in a society, and when violence is legitimate, which just wasn't there. The other assumption that Obama makes is that violent insurgencies usually blow themselves out. Or basically, if you ignore ISIS, they would eventually go away. Which has been true in the past but wasn't true this time. And I think the reason why that wasn't true is because there is that snowball effect. But again, that starts because of that debathification. There's a group of people already there because of the fallout from 2003.
Again, you've basically just admitted that these are two things that Barack Obama got wrong.
Yeah,
and if Barack Obama got them wrong, then they are things that he should be held accountable for. And in that essence, okay, he's not the only cause for the creation of ISIS. The debathification of Iraq certainly would have played a part in that. To me, by saying Obama got these two things wrong and they led to actions X, Y, Z, when you're talking, you know, in just about anything, if you say these assumptions led you to take actions which resulted in these poor outcomes, then that is admitting that that person has made a mistake and is responsible for that outcome.
But I think it's, which is more important, is it the debathification or is it what Obama does? Now, I think it should have been pretty obvious that sacking all the Iraqi army and having them unemployed, sacking all of the members of the Ba'ath Party from government jobs and leaving them unemployed was a recipe for disaster. That's an assumption you can make that was obvious, even without the use of hindsight, that it was wrong.
But again, knowing that, Obama could have turned around and actually reversed that and basically say, look, we got this wrong. Everybody who had a job with the party, you can come back to that job, provided you can demonstrate you're not actually a Ba'ath loyalist. Which, you know, for most of those teachers, for instance, would have been a relatively easy thing for them to do.
But I think if you're apportioning blame, more blame goes to Bush and the mistakes made in the original invasion than it does to Obama. I'm not saying Obama gets off scot-free at all. What I'm saying is you can't say Obama created it. He could have prevented it, but that's not the same as creating it. And he made some assumptions and they were wrong, but you can see why those assumptions were made. And there's other people that are more to blame than he is.
Well, if we're assessing Obama's legacy, and that is what we're talking about here, it's Obama's legacy and what role ISIS have in that legacy. Okay, yeah, sure, you can make the argument or say that George Bush, you know, had a very big role in the rise of ISIS. Fair enough, not going to disagree with that. But ISIS is clearly a very big part of Obama's foreign policy legacy because the actions that he took led to those things. Now we can led to the rise of ISIS. Now we can quibble about whether that means he created ISIS. Now that's obviously just a complete tautological argument which will, you know, get us nowhere in anything. I think for me, when we're talking about this sort of things, like with Iraq especially, if we're saying Iraq is the root cause of it, then actually we should blame George Bush Sr. for going in there and not finishing the job in the first place. You can, with these sorts of things, you can keep on going back and back and back. And if we're assessing Obama's policy and Obama's things, we need to look at what Obama did. And I think if you start going back to the president before, then you open up that can of worms where you need to go back to the one before that and the one before that. Or
I blame Richard Lightheart myself. Which seems like a good time to end this podcast about personal responsibility. If you enjoy our podcast, please do tell anyone you can. If you could subscribe on iTunes and leave a review and rate us, it does help people discover the show as well. Our theme tune is Plucky Good Times from Dave Depper, which you can find on freemusicarchive.org, and James Cram designed our logo, and you can follow him on Twitter at James Cram. I'm on Twitter at Paperback Writer.
I'm on Twitter as at Centre Radical.
And we'll be back next week, not talking about ISIS. See you then.